Well, we got up to slide 5, which I haven't talked about yet. And what's illustrated in this slide is the important concept that there is a close relationship between biological form and biological function. You've probably heard the phrase, form fits function. That refers to the fact that because of natural selection, because of the way natural selection works, organisms have structures the way they are because that happens to be what works in that set of conditions that the organism lives in. That happens gradually through generations by natural selection, which leads to evolutionary adaptation. Adaptation is fitness. And there's countless examples of this. This is just one example in slide 5 showing the interior of a bird bone. And you can see that bird bones are hollow or pneumatized. Which means air-filled. Like in pneumatic drill, powered by air. Birds are often described as these real fragile creatures that you have to be careful with. But really, they're pretty tough creatures. Their skeleton has to be tough because it has to stand up to tremendous forces in order for them to fly. Not all birds fly, but most do, including this example one. You know, moving the skeleton back and forth against the forces of the atmosphere is something that would break lesser bones. So bones are wide and hollow. They came to be that way gradually by natural selection, and that allows them to stand up to the forces. Now, you could make bones even stronger by having them the same diameter as this one, but solid. But what's the problem with that, of course? It's going to weigh a lot more, and therefore it's probably going to be prohibitively heavy, meaning the birds won't be able to get off the ground. So if you think, natural selection is not design, it happens accidentally, and what happens to work gets selected. But if you think about it from a design perspective, if you were to design a skeleton, you know, if you were given that as an assignment and you say, and you're told that you have so much material to work with, you can't go over that amount, then you could use all of your material in making solid rods. Right? But because they're solid, they would be comparatively small diameter. And the problem with that is that those would be comparatively easy to bend or break. Well, here's why. If this is a solid rod, but you instead use all of your material to make a hollow tube, they both weigh the same, but the tube has a much greater diameter. All right? When it comes to bending that, if you say you bend it at this point, at this angle, we'll say, notice that the larger the diameter is, when you bend this thing, the larger the diameter gets, the more you have to compress this, and on the other side, stretch it. Do you see what I'm saying? Whereas on this narrower diameter, that same angle of bending only compresses it this much. And that's why it's easier to bend a narrow rod than it is a wide tube. Does that make sense, that drawing? And this is why, for instance, as bikes evolved, the tubes on the bikes got much bigger and lighter because they used different materials, but they got wider and wider tubes, making them much stiffer. Same thing happens here evolutionarily in bird skeletons. They become, instead of being more solid and narrower, they became wider and pneumatized. But there's all kinds of other examples of that happening. Form follows function, though, simply means that anatomy came to be the way it is because that happens to work for physiology, the way organisms operate. All right, now to six. We have a couple cells here, and it's good that we have two because I want to tell you that there is a dichotomy of cell types. What is a dichotomy? Right, di means two, and a dichotomy is a two-part way of looking at things. So in terms of cell types, there is a dichotomy, meaning that whatever organism you're talking about, all organisms belong to either one or the other category I'm about to give you, based on their cell types, and those are prokaryotes and eukaryotes. Well, those are the organisms. The cells are called prokaryotic or eukaryotic. And notice the similarity of those words. They both share this karyotic part, which involves a root karyon that means kernel or center or core. Well, in terms of cells, that kernel or that center is a cell nucleus, if the cell has one. This bigger of the two cells here has a nucleus. The big blue thing is the cell nucleus. The smaller one doesn't. Pro means before. Prokaryotic cells are named for the fact that they've been around since before any nucleus existed. Nuclei came into existence much later than cells themselves did. So the original cells, and still by far most cells alive, are prokaryotic cells. U, spelled EU, but the prefix U means good or true. And so eukaryotic cells are named for the fact that they have a true nucleus. Well, that's what they're named for, the nucleus, but that's not the only thing that's different about them. First of all, a nucleus, if it exists in a cell, is an example of an organelle. We talked last time about the hierarchy of biological organization, which includes organelle as a level, right? There's all kinds of different organelles, and we'll survey those later, but a nucleus is an example of an organelle. More specifically, though, it's not just an organelle, it is a membrane-bounded organelle. And that phrase is sometimes misused, even in textbooks, membrane-bounded, because it's very similar to another phrase, which means something else. Membrane-bounded and membrane-bound are two different things. All right. Bound, to bound, the verb, means to form a boundary with. For instance, the United States is bounded by two oceans and two countries. All right? Forms a surrounding of. And bounded is the past tense of that. So membrane bounded means enclosed by a membrane. And the nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle because it has its own membrane that forms the boundary of the nucleus. Membrane bound, on the other hand, uses a similar word, bound, but that is not a verb. That is the past tense of bind, which means to tie or link to. So membrane bound means attached to a membrane and part of that membrane. And for instance, later in the semester, we'll be talking about membrane bound proteins. Proteins that are part of the membrane. They're not enclosed by a membrane, they're part of a membrane. You see the difference there? Well, not all organelles are membrane bounded. Most are. The nucleus is. And that is the etymological basis for these difference in these two names. But not only does a prokaryotic nucleus, a prokaryotic cell not have a nucleus, which is one kind of membrane-bounded organelle, it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. Things like mitochondria and chloroplasts and endoplasmic reticulum, the ones that we're going to talk about later. Those are also membrane-bounded organelles. Prokaryotic cells don't have those either. Well, speaking of membranes, every cell has at least one membrane because the membrane pretty much defines the cell. Every cell is bounded or is enclosed by its own membrane, either called the cell membrane or usually the plasma membrane. Cell membrane and plasma membrane, you can use interchangeably. They mean the same thing. That's really what defines the cell, because that is the boundary between the cell and everything else in the universe. That's what makes the cell, the plasma membrane that is, makes the cell a little enclosed package apart from the rest of the universe. This is why life exists, because cells act as little test tubes in isolation. In a chemistry lab, you can run chemical reactions in test tubes apart from other parts of the lab. Same thing is happening in cells. We talked last time about the fact that life is really just metabolism, the set of chemical reactions that are occurring in the organism. Well, those reactions occur in the little test tubes that we call cells, that are kept separate from the surroundings by the plasma membrane. So every cell has a plasma membrane. Prokaryotic cells have that membrane and that's it, because they don't have any other, they don't have any membrane-bounded organelles inside the cell that are enclosed by their own membranes. Eukaryotic cells do, though. They're named for the nucleus, but it includes other membrane-bounded organelles as well. This is important for various reasons, but just think about what it means in common sense terms. If you have a cell, which is already one chamber apart from the surroundings because of the plasma membrane, and then you have organelles inside that chamber that are themselves enclosed by membranes, that means there's more than one compartment within the cell. Just like interior walls within a house make that house more than one space. Prokaryotic cells are not like that. They have one compartment. The entire interior of a prokaryotic cell, this is the only compartment it has. And all of the stuff that's in that, collectively, is called the cytoplasm, which literally means cell stuff, because cyte means cell and plasm means stuff. There is also cytoplasm in a eukaryotic cell. It's the big one here. But it's not all of the stuff that's in the cell. And that's because of its compartmentalization by virtue of the fact that it has membrane-bounded organelles. For instance, everything that's inside the nucleus is its own compartment because of the nuclear envelope, which is the name for the membrane enclosing the nucleus. And that's separated from the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is the stuff that's inside a eukaryotic cell but outside of compartments in organelles within that cell. So all of this stuff in the nucleus we call the nucleoplasm, stuff of the nucleus. The ecru color, or whatever it is the cytoplasm for this cell. This is the nucleoplasm. Okay, now you also see that this is an average, there's exceptions to these. There's a range in cell size for both eukaryotic and prokaryotic cells, but as a good average, a typical eukaryotic cell is about 10 times as big in each of three dimensions as a prokaryotic cell, meaning it's 10 times as wide, 10 times as tall, 10 times as thick, which means volumetrically, a eukaryotic cell is about 1,000 times the volume, right? 10 times 10 times 10. You can see that roughly right here. You can fit 1,000 of those in here when you think about it in three dimensions. Like I said, there's exceptions to that because there are some extraordinarily small and extraordinarily big cells, but most cells are in a pretty narrow range, and we'll talk about why that's true later. Now, we'll have a lot to say about DNA as we go, but almost all cells have DNA in them, and all cells that need to live for very long have DNA. I say this because, for instance, in your own body, there's no DNA in your red blood cells. There is originally when those cells are developing, but then they lose it, basically to make as much room as possible for as much hemoglobin as possible that can get packed in there. But without DNA, they can't live very long, so they're continuously being turned over. You lose a billion cells of red blood cells every day and have to replace them. Most cells, though, have DNA for the entire lifetime of that cell. In a eukaryotic cell, you find the DNA in the nucleus, because a eukaryotic cell, by definition, has a true nucleus. Well, prokaryotic cells need DNA for the same reason that eukaryotic cells do. And eukaryotic cells wouldn't exist if it weren't for prokaryotic cells existing long before that, and some of those evolved into eukaryotic cells. So prokaryotic cells have DNA for the same reasons, and just as vitally important, but they don't keep it in their own compartment within the cell because they don't have any other membranes other than the boundary called the plasma membrane. So this blue stuff in the prokaryotic cell is the DNA. Notice that it's not evenly dispersed throughout the cytoplasm. It is in a region within the cytoplasm, but it's not a clearly defined region because there's no membrane forming that boundary. And so that place within a prokaryotic cell where the DNA is contained is called the nucleoid, which you should be careful with because a nucleoid is not a nucleus. It's named for the fact that it's like a nucleus, right? Oid means like, as in humanoid. But it's not truly a nucleus because does not have a membrane. All right, let's go to 7. This cell has to do with, in one way, it has to do with cell theory. Did I mention cell theory? I think I did kind of in passing last time. What about cell theory did I say is true? Right. Cells come only from pre-existing cells, at least nowadays. Cells no longer just pop into existence out of non-cellular stuff. That did happen originally, but now all cells are produced by cells that produce them. And usually that happens because of splitting. One cell that is alive splits into two cells that are now alive, didn't exist a moment ago. And by the way, when that happens, the original cell no longer exists now. It's replaced by two cells rather than adding an additional cell. And then each of those can split and so on. That's why there are so many cells, even in your own body, but many, many more in the biosphere. Well, here we have actually kind of an exception to how that happens. In sexual species, which is not all species, but it includes us, of course, plants, animals, many other kinds of sexual species, but in sexual species, there is a fusion of cells to produce new cells. Gametes, which are sex cells, one from each of the two sexes in the species, can fuse together to produce one cell. So that's the opposite of splitting. But then once that happens, and that's the zygote that you began at as officially, really you didn't begin there, you began 4 billion years ago when the original cells were created. You're just a continuation of that. But anyway, that zygote then splits to become multicellular. Eventually an embryo, eventually a fetus, eventually a baby, eventually an adult. While we're not deeply yet, but while we're slightly into the topic of DNA, by the way, which is combined in sexual species from the two gametes, but regardless of whether it's a sexual species or not, DNA in general has two major functions that we'll talk about over and over. In fact, the whole second half of the course is about DNA in one way or another. But there are two major functions to DNA. One is a process called transcription. And the other is a process called replication. Replication refers to copying, self-copying. DNA has the remarkable property of being able to produce exact copies of itself. And that's why one cell can split into two cells, both of which have exact copies of that original DNA, and therefore can live on their own. So that's one of the two important functions. Transcription is about using the DNA not to make new cells, but within the lifetime of that one cell before it splits, using the DNA as a code to produce other molecules that are also codes. Now, we like to say that DNA gives organisms its traits. Their traits, right? We say this all the time. That's only indirectly true, though. What directly gives an organism its traits are the proteins that that organism is able to produce. So you are the way you are. You're able to think the way you are. You smell the way you do. You see the way you do because of the particular proteins that your body is able to produce. The proteins directly give you your traits. But the thing is, no cell is capable of producing a protein unless it's told how to do so. And we'll talk about how this happens later. But proteins are complex molecules. They're polymers that need to be built, and a cell needs to be told exactly how to build them. There's no limit to the number of proteins that can be produced, but none is going to be produced in a cell unless the cell is told how to do so. DNA is indirectly involved in building a protein. It's not even direct in that process. Transcription uses DNA, which is carrying a code, in a sense, to build a second molecule, a related molecule, an RNA molecule instead of DNA, that now is storing the code. DNA's job is done at that point. But then, as we'll study later, RNA, now carrying that code, tells the cell directly how to build a specific kind of protein. And that protein will give that organism some sort of trait. the ability to do something, for instance. So that's the connection between DNA and traits. It's indirect. And that transcription process is one of the two major functions of DNA. We're looking at a DNA molecule in slide 8. On the right edge, we're looking at just half of what is called a double-stranded DNA. Now, DNA, first of all, is an acronym. What does that stand for? Right, deoxyribonucleic acid. So, DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, is just one type of nucleic acid. The RNA I was just talking about, which is ribonucleic acid, is the other major kind of nucleic acid. Nucleic acids are one of four really important classes of molecules that organisms use and produce. Those are called biological macromolecules because they're big. And we'll be going over all four of those as well soon. But anyway, nucleic acids, why were they called this? Any idea? When biologists named them this? Exactly. Well, at least in a eukaryote, which is where they looked to find them, the DNA, not all nucleic acids are in the nucleus, but that's exactly why they were called that, because the DNA, if you're talking about a eukaryotic cell like ours, is in the nucleus. So they were called nucleic acids, even though there's plenty of RNA outside the nucleus as well, and there's DNA. There's no nucleus in a prokaryotic cell either. Yeah, that's why they're called nucleic acids. And DNA is really a single, what we call one DNA, is really two nucleic acid molecules in one. The right edge here shows a single strand, and this is not nearly the entire strand. That's why it fades out from top and the bottom. It's enormously long, millions of these subunits long for one molecule. And that's one strand. That strand by itself is a nucleic acid. But another one gets together and meets up with it to form what we call one DNA, even though it's really two nucleic acid strands. And in three, this has been untwisted, but in reality, the two strands are twisted like two strands of a rope. Most ropes are more than two strands, but you can twist two ropes. And so that's why it's called a double helix. A helix is simply a corkscrew shape or a spiral staircase shape. And there's two of them because it's two strands simultaneously twisting around. Nucleotides, as labeled here, are subunits that when linked together make nucleic acids. But we have plenty of time to talk about all those particulars later. Okay, slide 9. As I said, this chapter's all over the place because it's just an introductory chapter. We'll get into specific topics one chapter at a time, starting with the next one. But in slide 9, we're looking at the two major categories of feedback mechanisms. When we talked about the seven major characteristics that living things share, one of those was regulation, and I talked about homeostasis. Homeostasis is possible because of one of these feedback mechanisms. Only one, though. And I'll explain why it's only one in a minute. But the two categories of feedback mechanisms are negative feedback and positive feedback. And in a sense, they're opposites of each other, as the names imply. But they're called feedback mechanisms because something in the process, whatever it is, feeds back to an earlier part of the process. Well, both of these feedback mechanisms exist in biology, but not with equal representation. Negative feedback mechanisms vastly outnumber positive feedback mechanisms. There are some positive feedback mechanisms, but they're comparatively rare. Nearly all feedback mechanisms are negative feedback because negative feedback is the only kind of feedback that can lead to homeostasis. Positive feedback never can. Now, in a feedback mechanism, there's a couple things that we should define. One is that there is some sort of variable, which, of course, is anything that can vary. And there's all kinds of physiological variables. The easiest one probably to just make sense of in your mind is temperature. It's an important variable, homeostatic variable. We maintain temperature because we die if we get too hot or too cold. But anyway, that's an example of a variable. For things to be just right, well, a variable can have any value. That's why it is a variable. But for things to be just right in terms of the cell surviving, that variable has to have, ideally, a certain value. And that ideal value is the set point. So there's a variable and there's a set point. There's also what we calculate as an error. If there is any, the variable at any given moment has whatever value, not necessarily the set point. And in fact, almost never exactly the set point. But the set point is the goal, in a sense. The variable is changing values. And so at any given moment, there is some mathematical difference between the value of the variable at the moment and the value of the set point, which is what's intended. And whatever that difference is called an error, because there is a difference. Zero, no difference, would mean this variable is exactly where it should be, but it's never going to stay there. It's never going to stay exactly at no error. Similarly, and by analogy, a thermostat in a room or a house has a set point, right? You put in what you want the temperature to be. But at any given moment in the house, the temperature is not exactly at that set point. At any given moment, it's either slightly above or slightly below. So there's an error, usually. Well, the thermostat works by trying to get rid of that error. And a word that means get rid of is negate. And this is exactly why the type of feedback that gets rid of the error is called negative feedback. It negates the error, regardless of which direction the error is in. Notice there's two directions the error can be. The room can be either too hot or too cold. So one error is that the temperature is too high right now, and the other error is it's too low. They're both errors, but they're in opposite directions compared to the set point. What I want you to understand, though, is it's not that if the temperature is in one direction, one type of feedback mechanism is used, and if it's in the other direction, the other type of feedback mechanism is used. That's not true. Regardless of the direction of the error, it's negative feedback that brings that variable back toward the set point value. If the temperature gets too hot in the room, the air conditioner is going to kick on to bring the variable, the temperature, back down to set point. That's negative feedback. But if it gets too low, the heater will turn on, also bringing it back to the set point. Positive feedback is just the opposite, in the sense that whatever the error is at the moment will be made even greater. For instance, if it's in the temperature analogy or example, because it's not an analogy, it's real. If it's too warm, positive feedback would make it even warmer, taking it farther away from the set point. And if it's too cold, it would make it even colder, taking it away from the set point in the other direction. That's why positive feedback can never lead to homeostasis. Homeostasis is that maintenance of a relatively constant environment. The real temperature is going to go up and down continuously throughout the day in a cell and in a room as well, but it stays within lethal limits because of negative feedback. So that's what almost all feedback mechanisms in living organisms are, negative feedback. But there are some examples of non-pathological positive feedback mechanisms. The one that almost all textbooks use is parturition, childbirth. What happens when it comes time is that in most cases the fetus is upside down in the uterus. So the head is pushing on the cervix, the narrowing of the uterus, and that's going to stretch that cervix. The lining of the cervix can sense the stretch and send nervous impulses to the brain, which, when it hears about the stretching, causes release from the pituitary of a hormone, oxytocin, which, as hormones do, gets put into the bloodstream and delivered to the entire body. But most of the body doesn't understand that signal. It doesn't have receptors for it, but the uterus does. So the oxytocin reaches the uterus, and the uterus responds, especially at the upper end, the blind end, where the feet are, by contracting. It's a muscular organ, so it contracts and squeezes the fetus farther downward. Well, that's going to push the head deeper into the cervix, which is going to stretch it even more, causing even more signal to be sent to the brain, causing even more oxytocin to be released, telling the uterus to contract even more, so it just keeps building. And eventually, if everything goes right, the kid pops out and the woman survives. By the way, that brings up the important point that all positive feedback mechanisms are temporary. They have to be, because they're non-homeostatic. So either they're temporary in the sense that they're pathological and they will kill you. That's temporary, because you only live until you die. Or, like in normal parturition, that where no one is killed, they are, once they do their job, they're quickly replaced by negative feedback mechanisms that restore homeostasis. In this case, we're looking at feedback mechanisms from the viewpoint of biochemical pathways. A biochemical pathway we'll study later is really just an end-to-end arrangement of chemical reactions. Each of these arrows is one reaction. But in this example at the top, A gets turned into B, which gets turned into C, which gets turned into D. And D is the final product of the pathway. Well, the cell needs D, whatever D represents. And that's why the pathway is running. But eventually there's a time when you've made enough D and now it starts to accumulate. And that accumulation will cause D, since it's becoming so prevalent, to feed back and turn off the pathway that builds D. So that's negative feedback. It automatically shuts off its overproduction. All right? But those are the feedback mechanisms. Now we can go to 10. This is another hierarchy. It's a classification of organisms is hierarchical as well. That's what we're looking at here. If you look at the top, well, each of these names at the top is the name of a specific kind of taxon, but taxon is a very general term that simply means group. So order is a taxon, genus is a taxon, kingdom is a taxon, but they're of different sizes because this is a hierarchy. So species here is the smallest taxon. It's the least inclusive, meaning it includes the fewest things in it. In this case, just this species of bear. That's the only thing in that species, which is one taxon. But a level of it, a taxon level above that, which is genus, includes not only that species, but other species. This is kind of like the hierarchy of biological organization, right? Each next level is bigger and includes more. Well, you've probably heard of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Those are taxa. These keep changing, by the way. Taxonomists are biologists that specialize in figuring out these groupings and deciding on them, and that changes with when evidence changes. But it's also drastically changed over the ages. We've been classifying organisms for millennia. Thousands of years we've been thinking about this simply because we notice things about nature. And for a long time, kingdoms were the biggest, the most inclusive taxa originally, and there were only two kingdoms. We lumped everything, regardless of what it was, all living things, into either animals or plants. Well, eventually we realized some things aren't either of those. And so there became more kingdoms, three first. By the time in the 70s, I was in fifth grade or so, when we first learned classification, there were five kingdoms. And those they were still the biggest taxa. Taxa is the plural of taxon. Well, nowadays, there's many more than five kingdoms, plus kingdoms are no longer even the biggest taxa. We've devised even bigger taxa than kingdoms. And those are the domains, which you see on the right edge. So, domains are currently the biggest taxa, and there are only three. So all organisms, not just the organisms alive right now, all organisms that ever existed belong to one and only one of those three domains. They're non-overlapping, in other words. You can't be in one domain and another. I'll talk about the domains in a minute, but while I'm showing you, you know, we get more and more specific as we go to species, which is the same root. Anyway, when we get to this end, we have genus and species. And so-called scientific names of organisms have two names, right? Like, what is it for humans? Scientific name for humans.
Homo sapiens.
Homo sapiens, yes. Or Quercus alba for a white oak tree. You know, everything has a two-word name, and that's why they're called binomials, which means two names. Nome means name, bi means two. So a scientific binomial is really just a listing of the genus, which is one taxon, that organism belongs to, and then the name of the species that it belongs to. So we say humans is Homo sapiens, the species. That's really not true. Humans belong to the genus called Homo. And we just happen to be the only species that still exists in that genus. All the others are extinct now. But there used to be other Homo members. The species is just sapiens. And the binomial is the genus and the species, Homo sapiens. Well, the proper use of a binomial, and you can kind of tell, I tried to do it as explicitly as possible. It's hard to do with printing. But to properly use a binomial, the genus name is always capitalized. The species name is never capitalized. And both the genus and the species name are always italicized. Whereas if you were talking about one of the other taxa, you wouldn't italicize it. Saying that vertebrata, for instance, for vertebrates, that wouldn't be italicized. All right? Anyway, let's get back to these three domains I was talking about. This is slide 11. As you see on the headers here, the names of these three domains are bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. And I want you to think back to the dichotomy of cell types that we've already talked about today. Right, there's two types of cells, eukaryotic and prokaryotic. And you probably already noticed that one of the domains, which there are three of, is eukarya, which not surprisingly is named for the fact that this domain includes all eukaryotic organisms that have ever existed, including us, of course. But there is no domain called prokarya, which is all the other organisms, right? I mean, it would be if it were a domain, but there is no domain called prokarya. The eukarya domain not only includes all eukaryotes, but that's all it includes. It doesn't include any prokaryotic cells. So all of the rest of the organisms, which collectively are prokaryotic organisms, are split into two domains, not just one. And those are bacteria and archaea. So all bacteria and all archaeans are prokaryotic. And it's easy to guess what is included in the domain bacteria. That's all of the bacteria, which by far, not even close, are the most successful organisms ever. That's always been true and likely always will be. Archaea is a domain that includes also prokaryotes, but they're not bacteria. They're the other prokaryotes. And if you were to put one of each on a microscope slide and look at them, you wouldn't really see a difference, at least at that level. So they're similar in appearance, at least microscopically, under a light microscope. But they deserve to be in their own domain because there are important differences to the chemical makeup of them, which allows us to figure out where in the history of life these three domains were created. The eukarya domain, that's new. Old from our viewpoint, because to us 100 years seems like a long time. But in the roughly 4 billion year process of life, eukarya didn't exist until just this last billion years. For a long time, the only cells were prokaryotic. And archaeans are not only different in important respects from bacteria, but really when you get down to it, we eukaryotes are more similar to archaea and vice versa than either is to bacteria. Bacteria are the more like the original cells. But those are the three domains. No overlap. You're in one or the other. Well, the pink and blue structure here is a cartoon in each case of a cilium, singular of cilia, which is a word that means hair. For instance, eyelashes are true cilia because they really are hair. These are not true hair. Mammals make hair. These are much tinier than hairs. They're little projections from the cell surface, but they appear hairy to us, so that's why we're called cilia. Anyway, the point that's being made here is that even though these two cells from which these two cilia are taken, paramecium on the left, what taxon is this, by the way? Paramecium. It's italicized and capitalized, so it's a genus name. And from us, a cell from the windpipe, or trachea, even though these are pretty drastically different organisms, an animal, in the case of humans, and a protist, which is a type of eukaryote for the paramecium example, so we're not too highly related anymore, but despite that, when you look at the cilium from each in microscopic detail, they're almost identical in how they're built out of the proteins that are involved. They both look like this in cross-section under an electron microscope. And that's not coincidence. That's not merely coincidence. It's just one of countless bits of evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms, all three domains, all organisms that ever existed, have a common ancestor, the original successful cells. That's why I said you didn't really start as a zygote. You started when those original cells began, and all cells that exist since then have come from that original ancestor. And that's why you can have in species that differ widely because they diverged from each other a long time ago, they can still have almost identical structures because those things worked well and were favored by natural selection, and they still work well. So they, even though mutations can change them, unless it changes them for the better, they're not really going to be, those changes aren't going to be accepted by natural selection. In other words, this was an accident that worked almost perfectly from the early on and therefore hasn't changed since. But it also just points out the common ancestry of all organisms. Well, let's talk a little bit more about natural selection in slide 13. This is a cartoon example that actually is a real example, but there's also countless examples of natural selection occurring. And remember, that's what Darwin is famous for, not evolution, but natural selection, which leads to evolutionary adaptation. Natural selection is widely misunderstood in the general public, but it really is not too difficult to understand. The proteins I was talking about earlier, giving individuals their traits directly, like I said, those proteins can't be built by any cell unless the cell has instructions for doing that. The DNA is the original source of the instructions. And the code is simply a sequence of nucleotides, like I showed you on that strand. If you change that sequence, just like changing letters in a word, it's no longer exactly the same code. And changes to DNA that occur just accidentally, either by environmental damage or for other reasons, like sunlight, it can cause changes to DNA, and those changes collectively are called mutations. A change to a DNA sequence is a mutation. When that happens, then the code is now different. And therefore, when that code is used to tell the cell how to build a specific protein, it's not going to be exactly the same protein, because the code is a little bit different. And this just happens accidentally in all species. Well, there is. That's why I was saying it's not a design process. There's no intention. It's just accidental. And you get a new version of a protein. Well, chances are that new version isn't going to work as well as the version that had been used up to that point. But there is a chance it could work even better. The point is, you don't know. It's just random. And this is why it occurs between generations, because that's when DNA gets passed on to other individuals. And they have a new version of DNA compared to their parents, especially in sexual species. Well, anyway, natural selection refers to the fact that if an organism just happens to have a new version of DNA that leads to even better protein versions of proteins to do a certain job than the ancestors had, it will allow that organism to survive with greater likelihood in the conditions in which it lives. And that's important because only if an organism survives can it pass its DNA on to the next generation. Right? So if it has a version of DNA that gives it an advantage, it is more likely that it will be able to pass that DNA on. If it gets a raw deal and gets a bad version of DNA that makes it worse off, it's not going to survive long enough to reproduce. And therefore that not as good version of DNA will not get passed on. That's the selection process that the phrase refers to. And we can see that here in this example. This is a population of insects. They are the prey species in this. This is a predator-prey reaction. The predator is the bird eating the prey. But there's all kinds of characteristics in any given species. In this case, the characteristic here is the color of the insect. And in any given naturally occurring population, there's variations in traits, variations in color right here. Notice that there are some darker ones and some lighter ones. Well, whether you are a light insect or a dark insect does not really affect your own ability to live your life as an insect. So that's not the point. But notice the black background. These insects are living on a tree or whatever that is fairly dark colored. And therefore, the lighter ones really stand out well by contrast, whereas the dark ones are pretty well camouflaged. That matters because they're prey to the bird. The bird does not prefer black or white. Gets the same nutrition from either version of insect that it eats. But it's not going to waste its time trying to find one specific color. It just jumps at whatever one it sees. And simply because of color contrast, the light ones stand out. So those are the ones that are going to be picked off. So the individuals that have the DNA making the proteins that make white-colored insects are at a disadvantage. And they likely will not live long enough, since the bird will eat them, to pass the code for whiteness on to the next generation. So the next generation will be made up of individuals with a greater frequency of the genes for blackness rather than whiteness. And over each generation, it should get darker and darker. Or not darker and darker, but more and more individuals of the total population will be of the dark version. All right, that's it. The darkness would be selected for in this case. because it's advantageous. Well, that is an increase in fitness of the populations, right? Because they're getting to a situation in which they're better able to avoid being eaten. There, just the opposite of this was, it was a famous case back when the Industrial Revolution hit, 1700s. Before then, we weren't burning much stuff. So there were moths, I think it was, that lived, just like these insects, on tree bark. But tree bark was fairly light-colored. So it was the opposite situation. There were dark and light versions of the moths, but the dark ones were disadvantaged because they stood out against the light bark. And therefore, they were rare because natural selection was selecting against them. But then the Industrial Revolution hit, and we started burning all these fossil fuels, and it just put so much soot into the air that the bark turned black. So the environment changed, in other words, and that changed the selection pressure. So within very short time, because of natural selection, the species evolved, the population evolved, so that most of them were black rather than white, because that's what worked to keep them from being eaten. And there was no one making any decision about that. It's simply what works is what's selected for. 14. This is a tree-like structure that's also a classification scheme. And we call these trees, these tree-like structures, phylogenies or phylogenetic trees. They're tree-like because of the branching. And so phylogeny is the modern kind of classification. Classification, like I said earlier, has been going on for thousands of years. But early on, it was really the only thing that mattered was what it looks like to us. Oh, the bat has wings. Let's call it a bird. Right? No importance was given to how they were related to each other. It's simply what they look like to us. Well, nowadays, we classify things based on evolutionary relationships. And we devise these trees in which a node is simply a branch point. And that's where speciation events occur, where what was one lineage breaks into two, and they eventually become separate species. Well, all of these involve these finches, as you see. Just one type of bird. So this looks like a tree unto itself, but this is really just one tiny part of a much, much bigger overall tree, the one tree of life, where the common ancestor of that overall tree, which would be like the one trunk of a tree, is that original successful lineage of cells billions of years ago that created all of the organisms that exist. Living and dead since then. So if we go back far enough, any two organisms are related because they came from that common ancestor, including humans and Paramecia. Even though they don't seem very similar nowadays, they have a common ancestor, and that's why their cilia are similar. 15 is the final slide in this chapter. And this has to do with the scientific method, which you might have learned before as a kind of a set of steps. Well, in the scientific method involves observation at first. That's simply because humans are able to notice things. We've been doing this for many thousands of years. We notice something, and since we're curious animals, it makes us wonder why things are the way they are. So observations just naturally lead to questions. we want to answer those questions, of course. And those answers, whether they're right or wrong, are called hypotheses. This seems very simple, probably, but about half of students confuse hypotheses and predictions. I see this happening all the time. Hypotheses are explanations. In other words, a hypothesis tells you why things are the way they are. And they're stated in such a way as though it's true, even though that hypothesis might not be true at all. It's a declarative sentence, in other words, a hypothesis. And a big word that really tells you it's a hypothesis is because. Now, in this simple example, the observation is that the flashlight doesn't work. There can be any number of hypotheses. There's just two shown here. But the hypothesis of the number one hypothesis is that the flashlight doesn't light because the battery's dead. Right? It tells you why. That's the explanation. And it pretends that it's correct, but you don't know that yet. The other one is that the flashlight doesn't work because the bulb's burned out. We're assuming it's a bulb with a filament. Anyway, here's the confusing part, or what a lot of students do confuse. A hypothesis is the explanation. A prediction is something that would happen if the hypothesis were true. And so if, linguistically, is an important word in a prediction, and will, obviously, is a prediction word, right? Predictions about the future. So saying, replacing the battery will cause the flashlight to light is not a hypothesis. That's a prediction. It follows, predictions in general, follow from hypotheses. In other words, you formulate a hypothesis, which is some sort of explanation. You don't know whether it's right or wrong. But then logically, if that hypothesis is true, then you can tell what would happen if it were true. And that's why predictions follow logically from hypotheses. And the reason that's important in science is that a prediction gives you a way of testing whether that hypothesis is true. And that is the essence of scientific experimentation. We test predictions to see whether they come true in order to tell whether the corresponding hypothesis is true or not. Now, this brings up another dichotomy. There's two major ways of viewing the world. Two systems of belief, I should say. And those are science and faith. Pretty drastically different, because faith... Well, let me start with science. Science is, you know, we have beliefs in science. But a truly scientific belief has to have evidence. Science is evidence-based belief system. And if there is no evidence, even if you might want to believe something, you're not justified in believing it without evidence. Also, even more stringently, and this happens all the time, if evidence points in one direction for a long time, and you are justified scientifically in having that belief, but then new evidence suddenly reveals you've been wrong the whole time, now you, as a scientist, are obligated to believe the new version of reality because of the evidence. Faith, on the other hand, is belief not only in the absence of evidence. So you believe something simply because you want to believe it, basically. It doesn't have to be any evidence. But also it's belief despite, in some cases, evidence to the contrary. So not only is there no evidence to believe what you believe, there can be evidence to disbelieve it. Still, you believe it. That's what faith is. And that's why science and faith are so drastically different. But the evidence part is important in science when it comes to experimentation. All right, so you get however many, you formulate however many hypotheses, each one suggests logically its own prediction, and each prediction therefore tells you how to set up an experiment to test whether that prediction comes true. Pretty simple in this case, the experiment for hypothesis one is simply to change the battery. The other experiment is simply to change the bulb, right? And you see what happens. That's running the experiment. Well, what happens if you run the experiment and the prediction does not come true? In this case, that would be hypothesis one. Battery's changed, it still doesn't light. What does that tell you? The hypothesis is wrong, exactly. It refutes the hypothesis. Now, it might not be entirely wrong, because some hypotheses are more complex, but it's at least partially flawed. And that's, by the way, not a failure of the experiment. We get negative results in science all the time, and they are valuable. They tell us a lot of things. Saying that something isn't true is sometimes just as valuable as saying something is true. Right? It gives us definite knowledge. What happens if the results of an experiment, the prediction, comes true? Yeah.
Doesn't that mean that it was correct, but you also do have to retest at the same time?
You do have to retest, and that's because it doesn't tell, if the prediction comes true, it doesn't tell you that the hypothesis is true. It tells you that the hypothesis might be true. And just to use this simple example, the light might have come back on when she replaced the bulb simply because in the case of unscrewing things to put a new bulb in, she simply jiggled wires that were loose. So she replaced a good bulb with another good bulb, but in the course of doing that, caused something else unrelated to the bulb to make it work. Which is why you don't say, okay, this proves that hypothesis is right. Instead, as you said, you do this experiment over and over, not just one scientist, but eventually many scientists all over the world over long periods of time, and for some sorts of hypotheses. And if that happens and the predictions keep coming true, then we eventually don't call them hypotheses anymore. We call them facts. Like gravity. You know, you can do this test. You can drop an apple and it's not going to go upward, I bet. Gravity is a fact. Another example is evolution. It's tested continuously and has been for many, many decades. Always comes true. So anyway, that's what we call facts. We never really know anything with absolute certainty. We're just using reason to call the things that are true the things that seem like they're true because their predictions never fail. But it does change, even things that we absolutely thought were fact, like Newtonian mechanics. Newtonian mechanics is how Newton described how objects in the universe operate, and we still teach this because it's easier than what has supplanted it as the truth, which is quantum mechanics. Newtonian mechanics works close enough. You get a good enough answer on a macroscopic scale. But when you get down to very tiny things, actually the math does not work. So it's not true. And quantum mechanics, which has been devised since then, is true in both cases, until maybe something else comes along and we realize we've been wrong on that. That's the point I was making earlier. In science, you can't just continue to believe something after the evidence points somewhere else. All right. See, by the antsiness, I must be out of time.